This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here is what's coming up.
Her grandfather was a diplomat in Zambia and saw Vice President Kamala Harris as a five-year-old, visited him in Lusaka. So it's a homecoming.
That's journalist Kathy Short reporting as U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris arrived in Lusaka. We'll have lots more coverage on Harris' trip coming up. And the UN Human Rights Council has concerns about Eastern DRC, while famed South African athlete Oscar Pistorius is denied parole. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Lusaka, Zambia, the third and final stop of her trip to Africa this week. Reporter Kathy Short was at the airport when Harris arrived and has this report.
I'm here in Lusaka at the Kenneth Kaunda International Airport, where U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has just landed to a thunderous welcome. She is with Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. She was welcomed by Zambia's Vice President Mutale Nalumango and other senior government officials. It was a thunderous welcome as dance troops danced and just welcomed her to Zambia, which many see as her second home because she has a personal connection to Zambia because her grandfather was a diplomat in Zambia and saw Vice President Kamala Harris as a five-year-old visited him in Lusaka. So it's a homecoming for Vice President Kamala Harris for the next 2 days. And also along the roads, right from the airport to a state house, we saw also a lot of people that gathered to catch a glimpse of her. And she is expected to hold talks, bilateral talks, with Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema, and also to have a press conference. This is Kathy Short in Lusaka, Zambia, for VOA News.
That was journalist Kathy Short reporting from Kenneth Kaunda International Airport in Zambia. As you just heard, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris left Tanzania today and has arrived in Zambia. She met President Samia Suluhu Hassan on Thursday in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. For more on the final day of her trip, I spoke with journalist Idi Uwesu.
Today, it was a day of saying goodbye. Tanzania goodbye to Vice President Kamala Harris, who she concluded her visit here in the country. And today, she had no public activities. It was only ceremonies at the airport where a Vice President of Tanzania, Dr. Philip Mpango, was the one who said goodbye to Vice President Kamala Harris. But yesterday, it was a very busy day for her since morning, where she met her host, President Samia Suluhu Hassan. And then she went to National Museum, where she laid a wreath at the memorial to the 1998 terrorist bombing of the U.S. Embassy here in Dar es Salaam. And then she also met young entrepreneurs who showcased their works to Vice President Harris. And it was one of the things that showed to impress VP Harris. And she said that they gave her great hope about the future of Africa and the world at large. In the evening, she went back to the State House, where there was a special iftar prepared by her host, President Samia Suluhu, and other delegates who came together with Vice President Kamala Harris. So it was a kind of historic visit of the Vice President Kamala Harris here in Tanzania, and everybody seems to be happy with her presence here.
Before she came, most people there had high expectations. Were those expectations met according to people you're talking to?
It's true, people expected a lot from this visit. And to some whom I've been talking to, they say, yeah, with agreements that have been made between the U.S. and Tanzanian government, say they are going to open various opportunities, especially jobs and income creation at the national level and individuals, since the projects that are going to be started or are going to be undertaken are going to have a lot of opportunities. Sectors such as health, education, technologies are the ones that are a number of people here in Tanzania. And you can see that most of the people are shown their appreciation with the support of United States that are going to put in such sectors.
That was Idi Uwesu. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. Harris began her trip to the continent on Monday in Ghana. She's the fifth major U.S. political leader to visit the continent in recent months, part of U.S. President Joe Biden's push to build stronger ties with governments on the continent. Harris spent much of her trip focusing on empowering women and youth, fostering innovation, and encouraging good governance. Pope Francis is expected to leave hospital Saturday pending the results of his medical tests. He's scheduled to take part in a Palm Sunday service at St. Peter's Square this weekend, an event that kicks off Holy Week services for Roman Catholics. The 86-year-old pontiff was taken to hospital in Rome 2 days ago, where he was diagnosed with bronchitis and given an infusion of antibiotics. The French news agency AFP says on Friday morning he had breakfast, read newspapers, and did some work in the private purpose suit in the hospital. Pope Francis has suffered a number of health issues in recent years and was hospitalized in 2021 for an inflammation of the lining of the colon. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A grand jury in New York has voted to indict former U.S. President Donald Trump on criminal charges. He's the first former U.S. president to face criminal charges. For more about the significance of this indictment and how it may be perceived in Africa, I reached David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York.
Basically, what happened is a grand jury, which is a group of civilians who've analyzed the evidence against Donald Trump, have returned a response and said he has a case to answer. What that means is the former president has got to come to court and respond to these charges. It doesn't mean he's guilty. It just means he has a case to answer. But the other part of this whole question is, what will this do for Donald Trump's campaign and also for the legacy of the presidency, broadly understood, in light of this unprecedented act of indicting a former president?
It's rare for former presidents to be indicted in Africa. There's only been one, I think, that was Zuma. And former President Trump also happens to be the leading opposition candidate. Many in Africa have been arrested, but it's been rare elsewhere.
Yes, this is true. But I also think the context is also different. So in many of the cases you mentioned, in Africa, for example, it's very difficult, one, to indict a sitting president, remove him from power, because obviously a sitting president has the immunity of office, but also they have the powers of the state. But once they leave office, it's also difficult in Africa because many times, unfortunately, we don't have the independence of a lot of the institutions, a lot of the prosecutorial arms of government, the judicial arms, the arms of justice, law enforcement, and so on. But in this context, I think it's really interesting in the case of Trump, even though he is a very powerful former president, but he still has to face the rule of law. Let's also not forget there's about four other cases that are going to be brought forward against Trump at the federal and also the state level, the Georgia case. He has another tax case in New York State and a whole range of other cases aside from this particular indictment. But what does this show us in terms of comparing the African context and the U.S.? That the rule of law is very, very important, that an individual cannot be a king. They have to be held accountable when they break the law after they leave office, and even a lot of times for some of the things that they might do in office that go against constitutional precept.
The principle of no one is above the law is very important, especially here in the United States. But what do you make of the perception of other people who think there's a thin line between that and persecutions, those who are concerned that maybe a leading opposition figure is being indicted at this time?
You know, I would personally not see it that way. I think the law is very clear about what should happen. In this particular context, we have this indictment, so we don't know the details of exactly what he's been charged with. That will be revealed next week. But the due process, right, those Fifth Amendment protections in the Constitution have been followed, and the individual has been given a chance to come to court, present himself, and respond to the charges. His attorneys will have a chance to look at the evidence to determine, one, whether the case will even go forward. A judge has to determine that because he's been accused by a city attorney for federal charges. So they'll actually have to determine whether the case will move forward. But secondly, if it does move forward, then he has a chance to defend himself. The challenge here is, as you mentioned, there's a very thin line sometimes between the politics and the legal, because both cycles are working at the same time. So even as the legal process is going forward, meaning the president is being charged for these indictments and he responds to those indictments, he himself is a creature of politics, because don't forget he's running for office. He's trying to be the nominee for the Republican Party. But he's also going to eventually, if he's nominated, run against a sitting president, Joe Biden. So it's also a political question. But specifically to the assertion that these are political games that are, you know, are being played to weaponize the judiciary, I don't think that is correct, because he will have his day in court and the due process has been followed.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with me earlier from New York. Human rights experts warn ongoing conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has trapped the country in continuing cycles of brutality and misery, which will not end until the fighting ends. The experts participated in an in-depth examination of the situation in the DRC at the UN Human Rights Council Thursday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Armed violence has forced more than 6 million people to flee their homes in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is the highest number of internally displaced people on the African continent. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, warns the conditions leading to this situation are worsening as armed groups increase the violence, notably in the eastern provinces of Ituri and North Kivu. More than 100 armed groups operate in the eastern provinces. Turk says M23, ADF, CODECO, and other rebel militias commit despicable attacks against civilians with impunity. Since October, he says more than 1,300 people, including 107 children, have been killed. He speaks through an interpreter.
The targeted violence endured by civilians in the conflict-affected areas include sexual violence of extreme brutality. This has historically been used as a deliberate weapon in the DRC and as a strategy of terror.
The High Commissioner says the people of DRC have a right to live in peace and without the fear created by these cycles of brutality. Bintou Keita is the head of the UN peacekeeping force MONUSCO in the DRC. She is concerned that the M23 continues to hold large amounts of territory outbreak in North Kivu's Petit Nord region. She says the group's attacks on local communities have displaced nearly 900,000 people.
Also, while all efforts are primarily geared towards dealing with the situation in the Petit Nord, CODECO and ADF seized the opportunity to wreak havoc in North Kivu and Ituri. At the same time, tensions between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda have continued to increase and are worrisome.
On Friday, there are news reports that the M23 militia is leaving some territory it holds after an East African Community force of Ugandan soldiers entered the border city of Bunagana. The DRC accuses Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels, a charge the Rwandan government denies. DRC's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Paul Mpole Losoko Efambe, says his government is making significant efforts to deliver on the country's international human rights commitments. He says the DRC is trying to strengthen its fight against the armed groups, particularly the M23 group. He adds, ending human rights violations in the DRC is dependent on ending the conflict in the East. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South African prison authorities say former South African Paralympic star Oscar Pistorius, jailed in 2016 for killing his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, was denied parole today. Once the darling of the Paralympic movement for pushing for greater recognition and acceptance of disabled athletes, Pistorius shot dead Steenkamp, a model and law student, in his bathroom in 2013. He said he thought a burglar was in the bathroom when he fired the gun. The athlete, known as the Blade Runner for his carbon fiber prosthetic legs, made history as the first double amputee to run in the Olympics. He was jailed in 2016, initially for a six-year term, but had the sentence increased to 13 years after prosecutors argued it was too lenient. Steenkamp's family had opposed the bid and have said they think he has not been honest about the shooting. You can see more on this story on viewafrica.com. For the first time, Mozambique's Defense Minister Cristovo Chum has asked foreign military personnel stationed in the country to share their knowledge with Mozambique's security forces to help end violent extremism. Charles Mangwiro reports from the capital, Maputo.
National Defense Minister Cristovo Chume told reporters in Maputo Thursday that his country wants the new military attaches of South Africa, Zimbabwe, Portugal and Ukraine to share their experiences in the fight against Islamist insurgency that has raged in oil-rich Cabo Delgado province since 2017. This was the first time the ministry has publicly asked for assistance. In the past, officials always said the situation in Cabo Delgado was under control. We would like to take this opportunity to point out, he says, that the African continent is confronted with challenges of terrorism and other transnational crimes, which require a collective effort by states to eradicate these phenomena that jeopardize the security and well-being of our peoples. In this context, he says, we encourage the new defense attaches to work hard with a view to streamlining the ongoing cooperation between nations as well as discussing new opportunities that are of common interest to our respective states. Mozambique has not been open about requesting assistance to fight the insurgency, mainly fought between militant Islamists and jihadists attempting to establish an Islamic state in the region, and Mozambican security forces. Civilians, public institutions and private vehicles have been the main targets of terrorist attacks. Chume said a multifaceted approach is needed to eradicate terrorism. To combat it, he says, the state favors a multidimensional approach that consists of a military response and the implementation of local development programs in affected areas. In the military response, he says, the government has the support of the Defense Forces of Rwanda and of the Regional Southern African Development Community's mission. Likewise, the country is benefiting from the support in terms of training provided by the United States and European Union, which has increased the combat capacity of Mozambique's defense and security forces. Meanwhile, in New York, Thursday, Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi told a meeting of the United Nations Peace Building Commission that Mozambique with the help of other countries, needs to do more to fight terrorists. Mozambique holds the rotating UN Security Council presidency for March, and news was reported by state-run Radio Mozambique as saying fighting continues in Cabo Delgado. Terrorism is not yet over in Mozambique, he said. And though the terrorists are fragile, they are still active, looking for new ways of acting, trying to win the minds of the population, especially young people. And it is time to intensify our combat. The insurgency has claimed thousands of lives since it broke out in 2017 and disrupting multi-billion dollar natural gas projects. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbu Yeboro, and Kila, our engineer tonight, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Niger has faced many challenges, including violent extremism and climate crisis. In each case, noted Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Niger has prioritized inclusion, community engagement, pragmatic solutions. The United States is committed to the close partnership we've forged together and to make it even closer, he added during his recent visit. Secretary Blinken announced nearly $150 million in new humanitarian assistance to help meet needs in West and Central Africa and the Sahel, created by regional instability.
That assistance will support the provision of shelter, essential health care, emergency food, safe drinking water, sanitation, hygiene services, and will also support vulnerable refugees and asylum seekers evacuated to Niger.
The United States is also supporting investments in the long-term security of Niger, including helping make Niger's law enforcement more effective in combating terrorism, strengthening border security, enhancing counter-narcotics capacity, stemming trafficking, and violent extremism. Secretary Blinken also discussed how to deal with the global food crisis.
We've been supporting immediate interventions to help those facing acute food insecurity. Just since the aggression by Russia against Ukraine a year ago, we contributed an additional $13.5 billion to address food insecurity around the world, but most of that has gone to Africa. We're by far the largest donor to the World Food Program as well and other international mechanisms that are helping to deal with food insecurity.
The U.S. is also supporting the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which has brought Ukrainian grain to countries across Africa, said Secretary Blinken.
Over 4 million metric tons of wheat have gone directly to developing countries as a result of this initiative. That's the equivalent of 8 billion loaves of bread. So millions of people around the world, and especially here in Africa, rely on this initiative to help deal with food insecurity. It's imperative that it's imperative that Russia allow it to continue.
Beyond emergency aid, the U.S. is making long-term investments in African food production capacity and resilience, because ultimately the goal is for African countries to be able to produce their own food. There are many other ways in which we are working together to deepen this partnership, said Secretary Blinken. Niger is really an extraordinary model at a time of great challenge, a model of resilience, a model of democracy, a model of cooperation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.